Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Welcome to the official Tennis.com podcast, featuring professional coach and community leader, Kamau Murray.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is the Tennis.com podcast. I am your host, Kamau Murray, and today we have a very, very special guest. This is, in my neighborhood, we call him the OG. This is one of the greats. This is somebody that paved the way for a lot of players that we watch currently playing. She's a secret mentor to just about everybody black in tennis. This is appropriately timed because she's also a gold medalist and a Wimbledon finalist. This is Zena Garrison. Zena Garrison, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Kamau. Thanks for having me. And people always forget I'm also a bronze medalist in the 1988 Olympics as well.
Ah, and singles.
In singles, yes.
Well, that was a year because you won gold in doubles and in singles that, and then won bronze in singles that year.
Yes, that was, and actually I beat Pam Shriver in the quarterfinals to actually have the opportunity to play in the semis. So that was pretty interesting too. And then Pam and I went on and won a gold medal.
Oh Lord. Now how was that, having to beat her in the singles and then, you know, reunite and keep going for the doubles title?
It actually was kind of, we were also roommates. So it was very interesting because, you know, Pam and I always tell the story, you know, definitely, you know, what you call Mud and Jeff kind of thing. Pam's very tall. And white. I'm black and short. And so, you know, she's slew-footed, I'm pigeon-toed. So we were definitely, you know, two of a, you know, different makes up. You know, I came from, you know, my dad was a postman and Pam came from, you know, a little bit of money. So it was always kind of different. But we have developed what we call the Soul Sisters from getting our medal in Seoul, Korea. So we call ourselves the Soul Sisters for life.
Okay. Now they don't have roommates now with all this COVID and all the protocols.
Yeah.
But that is interesting. But that talks about the times, because over your career, you have been roommates with a lot of people, right? Or allowed a lot of people to be your roommates. Take me back to when you were the leader of the pack. You know, your pack was you, Lori, Katrina. Take me back to those days where you were the leader, you were making a bunch of money, everybody was coming behind you. Tell me about those good old days.
Well, like you say, a bunch of money, relevant to the times, not a bunch of money, but today's situation. But you know, it was okay during that time. But you know, I came up in the era. You know, before me there was Leslie Allen, Renee Blunt, Kim Sands, and you know, even before then there was Arthur Ashe out there, Gibson. And so I was always taught to, you know, especially the minority players, to kind of give back and to, as far as your wisdom when the next generation was coming up. So it was kind of easy for me because people helped me when I came up. And so it was very easy for me to help. And I used to love, you know, talking about what you could do to improve your game or just being on the tour, things that you might have to deal with that most people would never even think that a minority player had to deal with.
Now, I'm from Chicago, so even before I had the chance to meet you, I learned about you through Katrina Adams, because Katrina was always saying how you looked out for her. And a lot of people don't really know that you know, were very instrumental, you know, and then Katrina primarily played doubles, right? So a lot of doubles players get to share rooms, all the prize money they get, they got to cut in half. And so, you know, it's hard to make a living in doubles. And you were instrumental in sort of her being able to stay out there early on. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, even to the point, Katrina moved here for like 5 years in my and you know, was able to work out. And, you know, she was a young one coming up and just took her under our wings and just allowed her to, you know, play doubles with her. Besides, she was a really good doubles player, you know, so that was easy. But to play doubles with her allowed her to make money and be able to train and work out. And, you know, my family absolutely loved her. So for 5 years, she was part of the Garrison family here in Houston, Texas, as well as the community.
Mm-hmm. And that community is famous because you got Carl Lewis down there. You know, I met Jackie during the cursor through you, and always hear about these infamous track workouts that you all would go through, even though you all were playing a different sport. I always hear about these times on the track, even from Katrina, Lori. Tell us a little bit about what that was like to be able to train with Carl and Jackie Joyner.
Well, actually, it was more with Jackie. I actually trained with Bob Kersey I would actually go out to LA and train, and then they would come here and we'd train over at Rice University sometimes. And those were actually some of the best times and some of the most amazing times. But for me, I'll never forget going out onto the track with Jackie and Bobby. And so Bobby told me to run around the track, and I thought I was like running and I thought I was doing good. And then I see all these Olympic athletes and they're, you know, they're like laughing at like Gail Devers and all of those guys, and they're laughing at me. I'm like, what is going on? And Jackie's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, running. She goes, that ain't running. So that's when I first learned about the technique of running. And I remember Bobby used to get me up at 5 o'clock in the morning to teach me the technique of running. And, you know, you got to make sure you kick your foot back and it should touch your butt and, you know, all of that. And your arm shouldn't be all over the place. And so I had to learn how to run. And then I remember after being out there for about a month or so and coming around the track, and everybody's like, yeah, Zena, finally, you learn how to run. So, you know, Jack is one of my best friends, and, you know, Bobby, and it's just, you know, it's just amazing what the Olympics brings about, meeting so many people that will be your lifetime friends. And so, you know, I'm one of those people right now waking up and I'm watching the Olympics, and I now become a fan of the new 3-on-3 basketball. You're like, I think that's like the coolest little sport going on right now.
Mm-hmm. So I've had the opportunity to travel to, you know, every Grand Slam and almost every stop on a WTA tour, but I've never had the chance to go to the Olympics. So what's different about the Olympics? Because you look at the draw now and you see a lot of the American women, you know, sort of going out early. A lot of the big names, you saw Osaka kind of lose early. Is it more pressure? Is it less pressure? Do you, you know, to me, when you look from outside looking in, you would think that you got a whole team of folks kind of putting the battery in your back and putting a little gas in your gas tank, and that will sort of make you play better. But that's not always the case. So tell me what your perception is, the difference between, let's say, you know, a Grand Slam and an Olympic game.
Well, I think, first of all, it is totally different than anything that you can imagine, because you're not just playing for yourself and for your team, meaning a team of people that normally with you, you're all of a sudden playing for your country. And so it to me, it's one of those, it's a weird kind of situations, because you're still, you're an individual athlete that's going, and all of a sudden you're put into a team and a team of U.S. people. And also you become a little fan, you know, fan, like, oh my God, there is such and such over there. Oh, you know, the basketball team just switched. So you have your own kind of like, you know, mental thing that's going on, but you still got to play in the midst of all of this. And I always like to say, you know, of course, this is a little different because they don't have the fans and everything, but when you see the other athletes that, and you know that they've put in the time and the work and to get to this position and just as well as you, it's a very interesting and a weird kind of sorority fraternity thing that you will be in for life. But then when you win a gold medal or win a medal, it's a whole nother level as well. And as far as tennis players, it's always interesting to me because when you watch the draws kind of dissolve and some of those top players are not in there, a lot of times I feel, and this is my personal opinion, sometimes the focus is not all on them and they're not used to it. And so that takes a little away from that mystique. And that's why you sometimes get people that you never even heard of that could actually win a gold medal, win a medal in the sport. And it just happens like that. So you have to kind of go in there kind of knowing that you're not going to be the center of attention and just play for whatever it is and enjoy the moment to be successful.
It's interesting you say that because, you know, a lot of tennis players do need, you know, they need that attention. They need that sort of that air to walk around and be in the feeling of being the man in an environment. And with tennis, you know, we're like a small sport when you think about, you know, soccer, basketball, you know, when I think about the Olympics, track and field comes to mind mm-hmm. more than anything. So that's interesting how you say that the attention is not on you and you could sort of fade because, you know, you got the dream team, right? You got Kevin Durant over there. You got, you know, all the basketball players over there and they are bigger stars, you know, so you can kind of get starstruck and get out of your zone of being, you know, your own sort of celebrity and sort of like, it could take away a little bit of your power that you need to believe in yourself to perform.
Yeah, because I remember in 1988, you know, being over there in Seoul, and I actually took my brother, who Rodney Garrison, who absolutely loves sports. And I was disconnected with them for a couple of days, and I never forget. I was trying to figure out like where he was. He was in Family Village, and I was over in the in the, you know, the players participants village. And so I remember being in line and I remember Roy Jones, they were talking about, oh yeah, this guy and, you know, his sister's a black tennis player and blah, 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 blah. And I went over and I was like, can you take me to my brother? And I remember going in and like the families are partying, everybody's having a good time, you know, but I'm saying all I like to say is that's how small tennis was. Like nobody, they were in the Olympic Village, but there were so many more other sports and, you know, tennis just happened to be there. I mean, I hadn't spoken to my brother in 3 days and I went over there, but Roy Jones, like took me over there and my brother knew everybody in track and field, you know, kayak and it didn't matter.
That's amazing. Now you mentioned, you know, the families and the fact that you took your brother, right? This is sort of an odd Olympic time because all the stands are empty and a lot of athletes are getting the chance to sort of play without fans. And, you know, it's different, you know, because the fans are, you know, whether you admit it or not, the fans are the battery in your back, right? And, yes. And athletes love that attention and they love that excitement. And without the fans, it takes a lot of sort of inner determination and inner, you know, you got to kind of like, you know, create your own energy, which a lot of athletes struggle to do. What would you be thinking right now if you were over there in a spectator-free environment?
Well, it would definitely be different, especially the Olympics. I mean, because that's like, I mean, I can't even imagine how they're feeling right now, because it's such a country, you know, you're playing for your country, everybody's looking in, but you need that energy to pump yourself up a little bit. And me being a big introvert and, you know, people would never imagine that I'm an introvert, but when I got on the court, I love the energy from the people. So, you know, I was just watching a little bit of the doubles. I think Francis and Ram were playing and just the energy, you know, just watching them trying to build energy off themselves or looking over the stands from the team. That's a little tough, but, you know, they got to do what they got to do.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Yeah, this is the Tennis.com podcast. I'm your host, Kamal Murray, and we are with the legendary Zena Garrison. So, Zena, you talked about being an introvert, and a lot of people, they wouldn't think that because you were successful. You were so successful as an athlete, and you mentor, right? So you give a lot of bit of yourself, a lot of yourself to other people. But I remember you and I talking about how you would just be so emotionally drained and have to disappear for a couple of days after being out in the public.
Yeah.
So much. Talk about that.
Yeah, you know, it's just really interesting because one of my mentors, Billie Jean King, I remember being her assistant coach, and we were in Ancona. And I remember her saying to me, "Zena, go take a nap." And I was like, "Well, I don't need a nap." And she's like, "Zena, you, when you're around people, like it takes a lot." You know, she told me, "So you're an introvert." And I said, "Yeah, I am." She said, "It takes a lot because you're giving, 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 giving." And she said, "But that's not your personality. So you need to go and re-motivate, you know, get that engine running again by getting away from people." And I started noticing that I could go 3 or 4 days very strong. And then it's like, okay, I need to step away for a minute. So Billie Jean King was actually the first person that helped me notice, you know, with an introvert, it might seem we're on that stage and we're giving it all and we're talking to people. But then when we get back, we're like, "Oh, I'm so drained." She was the first person that helped me realize that there is a such thing. So when I see someone like a Naomi Osaka, I get her probably more than most people. Sometimes you just got to step back.
Mm-hmm. You know, what's funny is, I'm a middle child in a middle class family. And so I had the opportunity to hide a lot in my house, you know, because my brother was 6'9". He was a basketball superstar. He was smart. He was everything. And then my little sister was, you know, high jump champion, swim champion, super smart, you know, all of that kind of thing. And so I was sort of, taking public transportation home, kind of finding my own way through life and through tennis. My parents didn't play tennis, so I kind of navigated a lot of that myself. And you know, when I started raising money to build the center in Chicago, I had to be like out there, you know, talking to people, networking, you know, standing up. And people thought I loved it, or they think that I like enjoyed like being out and doing that kind of thing. But I would like sit in my car for 30 minutes after, you know, talking to somebody or going to an event and just like sit there because it was so draining. And, you know, to your point, you know, even at a tournament, I'll come back from Wimby or something like that, and I will like not answer the phone for 3 days just because I've been around so many people, and it actually makes me really uncomfortable. And so it's like you said, it's the opposite of what a lot of people think, because, you know, I too, and you know, will go and hide for a couple of days just so I could recenter myself, because a lot of the attention you get from the outside is not real.
Yeah.
You know, and it can kind of take you away from, it could take you up, right? And make you believe you're bigger than you are. Or it can also beat you down, you know, because now you got public criticism for, you know, your player lost or whatever happens. And so, you know, I definitely can relate to the misconception that you enjoy the attention, you enjoy, you know, even, you know, talking about tennis on TV or being at an event, you know, because it is not natural. And I do think that that's I can relate to just the emotional exhaustion, you know.
Yeah. And the other thing that I found out too, the more passionate you are about helping others or even caring about someone else, you know, just or how the world is working or different things, you take on a lot. And sometimes that sucks and zaps your energy because you want to do something about it. So you got to find that happy balance between it.
So let me ask you this. we talk about, you know, obviously tennis being a small sport and, you know, the Olympic Games, you see all these bigger athletes. But even within our small sport, there are certain people that have like this top dog air and glow about them. I can remember it was a rainy day at Wimbledon and Roger walked through the player lounge, you know, at the top there, the food lounge, everybody walked through, everybody kind of piled in one area, you know, trying to hide from the rain because there's not a lot of places to hide. And, you know, he already has like a swag that is just unmatched. But I remember seeing him walk down the aisle and seeing Nadal step out of his way. And I was like, now Nadal is probably the second best player at that time. But yeah, the way that he moved out of his way to sort of leave, to create room for Fed was like, now that's that shows that dude's on a different level. Who in your era had that glow or that air about him?
Yeah, it's funny because I came up in a couple different eras, but Martina Navratilova definitely had what I call a strut. And she demanded a certain level of games when you got on the court, because you're like, oh Lord, I'm playing Martina, you know, but she had that air that you were talking. And then Steffi Graf, because Steffi was, you didn't quite know that much about her, and she was in and out and she would beat you so quick that she had that, you know, little air. I was really fortunate because with Steffi, you know, Steffi would be on and off the court so quick, but she liked to go to, she loved Chinese food restaurants. And we'd end up, and both of us love Chinese food. So we'd end up getting Chinese food from the same restaurant over and over. So, and then end up sometimes at the movies, you know. So she was, I just happened to be one of those people she would speak to. But I would say Martina and Steffi for me had that kind of air. And then on the other side, probably Sampras had a little bit of it.
Yeah, I could see Steffi kind of having it. Martina, she got that bounce. She still kind of has that glow.
Martina's always going to have that bounce.
she got that bounce when she sort of walked through kind of side to side, kind of quick, moving kind of quick. And oh, hey, come on. Hey, how's it going? That kind of thing, right? I remember that one time she was in Chicago for something and her flight got delayed. And I took her to dinner at her favorite Asian restaurant in Chicago, which is no longer there, a restaurant called Japanay. And it was just the most interesting conversation, you know, from a champion. And she talked about how it was actually a little bit of a, even though, like, you know, for your, you know, she keeps you up at night, right? If you got to play her, you know, you win for the day. But from her standpoint, she talked about how it was a challenge to be number one and to be the top dog. It wasn't always a great feeling. You got to four in the world. How did you feel being four in the world? Because from, you know, when you look at it, if you're four in the world, almost every loss is a career win for somebody else.
Yeah.
Right. And it's only three people that you can lose to and it'd be somewhat understandable, right? Or not a bad loss for you. What is that pressure like? To only be able to really lose to three people and need to beat another, you know, the 95 people below you?
Well, for me, it was always tough. And for some reason, I played Martina like 30 something times. And it was always like in the semis or to go to the finals or in the finals. And so Martina was kind of like that person that was blocking me from even probably moving up to 3-2. But Kamal, to be honest, for me, I just always wanted to be the best that I could be. And I would push myself to, you know, to keep improving. I was one of those players. I just hated losing to certain people. You know, I just felt, you know, my game was better. Not that I personally was better. My game was better and I should not lose to those people. But on the other end of that, I also was one of those that, you know, you ask a young player, oh yeah, I want to be number one. I never wanted to be number one. And people always say, what? What are you like? What are you talking about? I never wanted to be number one because I didn't want the pressure of all of the other outside world things that I would have to do. I never wanted that. You must remember, like I said, I was an introvert. So it was like I could have been number two, three, or four, and that would have been fine. But I just hate losing. But I didn't want all the extra added pressure that it brought on. So I knew that at a young age.
Now, it's interesting you say that because we think about somebody like Nick Kyrgios, who probably has the talent to be number one.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly doesn't want to be, right? And the world has a problem with that. What do you think about, you know, A, other people putting expectations on people that they don't want, and B, just really talk of like you just said, it's okay to not want to be number one, and it's okay to find an altitude that you're comfortable flying at. What is your take on his situation and sort of his behavior?
Yeah, I think he's, you know, he's an interesting character in a lot of ways, because I think he's very clear on what he wants. I think sometimes the losing does become too much for him, because, and when I say that, is he knows he's better than most people and he loses, and then you bring on all the other stuff. But he knows that if he wins just enough, he has a platform to help in a lot of other ways, and I think he's very comfortable with that. But you know, I'm one of those people in the respect, just with Nick, is just like, I just want him to win one Grand Slam. So just, you know, focus just long enough for one Grand Slam, and then you would be even have a bigger platform. But, you know, he knows what's important to him. Just don't want to be in the situation where you look back and it's, and you say, wow, I could have done better, you know?
Now, let me ask you this. You know, right now we see an emergence of Black tennis players and, you know, the assistance that they're receiving is, you know, they're getting more access to, you know, people wanting to invest in their careers and giving them a little bit of help early. We know Osaka had a lot of help from Japan. We know Coco gets a lot of help from, you know, overseas. You know, in your era, there wasn't a lot of help. And you learned to play at McGregor Park, right, in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you make it? Because back in your day, we weren't making it. We weren't. I mean, it's like you were like, I don't know if you know this, but you were like some mystifying personality that learned how to play tennis in the park and got to number four in the world. You know, you didn't go to any fancy academies or go overseas and all this other kind of stuff. You made it from right there. How do you explain your success?
The only way I can explain my success is I was very loyal and honest to the coach that brought me up, John Wilkerson, and to my community. And to me, that, you know, I was a weird kind of kid because I understood where my confidence within myself came. And that was my community. McGregor Park, you know, John, the people that I played tennis around. But I also have to give credit to, you know, after winning Junior Wimbledon, that actually kind of put me on the map as far as people started like understanding that I could be the, you know, the next major Black tennis player. And so Arthur Ashe, you know, gave a lot of advice to me as well, but just the Black community within itself. And if I really needed to go to a tournament and didn't have it, my mom and her friends and the people in the community, they would sell, you know, fish dinners, they would sell, you know, barbecue, whatever it took. And also back in those days, I had the opportunity, I found out at the early age too, you could win scholarships with, you know, if you played in a tournament and you did well, there was normally what was called a sportsmanship award, and they would give $2,500 here, $3,000 here for different things. So every time I go to a tournament, that was my goal, to be good enough and nice enough to everyone that I would win the sportsmanship award, and that would allow me to go to another tournament, and things just started rolling for me after that.
Wow. This is the Tennis.com podcast. I'm your host, Kamal Murray, and we are here with the legendary Zena Garrison. So Zena, you mentioned that Arthur Ashe was sort of a mentor and, you know, gave you advice. You know, Serena has been very public about your role in, you know, being a mentor to her over the years. I remember an interview where she said, oh, my dad took me and Venus to see Zena Garrison and, you know, blah, 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 blah. Talk about that relationship a little bit early on and what you told them early in their careers, you know, as a way of motivation or to help them navigate this tennis scene.
Well, one of the biggest things is, you know, I have to give credit to Richard and also Orsine, but Richard would call me at 6 o'clock in the morning, like, hey, you're not up. Why are you not practicing? You know, hey, what about this? And I remember one of the things that he asked me about, I never forget this, is he asked me one morning, he's like, hey, you know, a lot of people are telling me that Venus now needs to play junior tournaments. And, you know, but I was just thinking about taking her straight on to the pros. You know, we have some contracts coming up or whatever. I'm like, why would you have her play junior tournaments now when she's got all this press? And, you know, let her play a professional tournament. And so I know he had a couple other people that told him that as well. And I think it was the right decision for him at that time. Just because Venus was so, so gifted and it turned out perfectly fine. But I'm saying all that to say is, you know, a lot of people want to follow the Richard Williams way of doing it, but a lot of people don't have Venus or Serena. So that's not going to work for everybody. But one thing Richard would do, he would ask questions. You know, he would ask questions to different people about different things. And he studied the game and he studied people. And I think it worked. Well, it did work for him.
Yeah, I look at these kids now. You could name, you know, five or six parents that tried sort of the Venus and Serena method of never playing juniors. And I was saying, and from a broad standpoint, I disagree with it. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, your job as a tennis player isn't to play well. It's to win tennis matches. And learning to win tennis matches, you know, you got to put them out there to see if they actually can compete. You know, not just hitting forehands and backhands. You got to put them out there to just sort of see if they can compete. So that just sort of is always my big caution when I talk to parents who, you know, don't want to put them in junior tournaments, or maybe either they're afraid of, you know, running from a bad loss, or yep, just trying to, you know, not kill the hype that they create. You know, if you never play, you never got to kind of stand up to the hype. But I always believe it's best to kind of stick the player out there to see if they can compete, you know, because the job is to compete. It ain't to just, you know, make some serves, make some forehands, make some backhands. Can you win tennis matches, right? And that takes practice.
I agree with you on that. I mean, I think more kids should play junior tournaments than not. but I also, even more, and you know, you and I talk about this a lot, you know, we have gotten to really get the path of college tennis back strong the way it used to be. Because now these kids that have gone to academies and everything and don't quite make it, or, you know, professional level, whatever, then they're lost. So I think it is getting better. And I think, you know, I know the USTA is actually putting more emphasis on it. And so we've had more people like a Brady and Isner that you can see that you can still go to school and then come out and still play professional tennis and have a great career. But even more in the HBCU schools, I mean, we've got to get that stronger as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I remember, you know, a lot of times I come back from a pro tournament and, you know, people come in, pop in Chicago, visit, and they will, you know, bring their kids in and have me sort of evaluate them, and good players. And I always say, hey, I just left, you know, Beijing and I was on the court with blah, 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 or, you know, Coco Vandeweghe, Madison Keys, and they was popping them serves. And your serve is good, but it ain't like that, right? Yeah. So you should go to college. And I think that you know, without having that up close and personal view of what a professional looks like, you know, you can sort of, you know, my dad used to say, pimp past your stop.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Where you don't really know where you fit in because you don't know what good looks like. And so I think that leads into it. So I got a couple of questions. I know you've been very generous with your time, but I have like questions just from somebody who's been basically everywhere on tour. Mm-hmm. And just to get your preferences, do you prefer grass or clay?
That's not even a question. definitely grass. Absolutely. From the very first time I played on it, I fell in love with it.
All right. So Wimbledon, court 18 or court 3?
Actually, neither. If it's not center court, it's court 1. I'm a serious hot dog. Always love the major courts, but the further back you put me, the chances of me losing could be greater. So, but I always try to stay a high seed so I can at least play high on one of the better courts.
Indian Wells or Miami?
Indian Wells.
Roof open or closed?
Probably. I'm the old era, so I wasn't used to outdoor tournaments being played indoors, but I always loved indoor tournaments. So I would imagine I would love indoors faster, able for me to get to the net, move the ball around a lot more. So I would probably have loved the roof closed.
Okay. There was no Airbnb back then, but y'all did rent flats and stuff. So hotel or Airbnb?
Oh, definitely Airbnb. I love to cook. In 1990 Wimbledon, I cooked my whole entire 2 weeks that I played up right up until the finals. And I would make breakfast for everyone and, you know, bring my lunch.
So that's my next one. When you're at a tournament, are you doing a team dinner or are you going out solo?
Oh, definitely team dinner. I needed to kind of wind down with everybody and get a little laugh. And, you know, I was definitely a team dinner.
All right. Tie break for the set or win by two?
Win by two.
Oof.
I want you to feel it when you come off that court. I want you to go as long as you can and no lucky shots to just change the match.
Wimbledon whites or colors?
I'm a traditionist, and Billie Jean King would probably kill me saying I like the whites, but, you know, the times should be able to wear different colors if you want to, but I like the green and the white background.
Mm-hmm. Crowd for you or against you?
Oh, definitely crowd for me, but I was a little, if the crowd was against me, that would give me a little more oomph.
Mm. And the last question is, I asked Mal this question about his Wimbledon run. You know, I always say in order to get to a Grand Slam final, even to win a Grand Slam, you got to get it right for 14 days. And I mean, everything got to go right. You got to have the right practice court, the right practice partners, the right hotel, the right dinner. You can't get food poisoning. You can't get bed bugs. Can't get caught in traffic. Got to have the right draw. Everything sort of has to line up to go right. What was special about that run to Wimbledon?
And don't leave out, you gotta have a little luck.
And you gotta have a little luck. Somebody gotta lose that you just don't want to see.
Exactly. I think what was special about that Wimbledon is, and it's so funny to me because I listen to people right now and I hear, you know, people are starting this, you know, talk about, you know, I'm someone working with someone for the mental coaching and all that. Tennis players have always had that. They just never like said it. Mm-hmm. But I remember in 1990, I had my mental therapist there. And I remember, you know, 3 or 4 months before then working on one shot that I kept, you know, missing on crucial points, and it was just a total block. And finding out later it had something not even to do with tennis. It was just a block that I was going on within my life. And make a long story short, I remember getting that. I was down match point. I got the same forehand right in the middle of the court, right behind the service line. And I got this forehand and I was down match point against Monica Seles, who was on a run, and I cracked the forehand down the line and I didn't look back and I made it to the finals of Wimbledon. And I remember that just being a real big team break for me, because I also had my mental coach there. I had my trainer, who actually died from breast cancer not much longer after that. I had my coach, who Sherwood Stewart, who had played and I had won the Wimbledon mixed doubles with prior to. I had my, you know, now my ex-husband was there, and I had, you know, two family members, Al and Velma. And it was just like, for me, it was just a win for my team, not just me. And that was the first time that I realized, you know, you're playing an individual sport, but there's so many more things and so many people that had to be put in place for me to get to that final.
Now, let me ask you this question, because I always wonder this, right? You played the entire Wimbledon. I don't know if people know this. You played the entire tournament all the way up into the finals without a clothing deal.
Yep.
And you were wearing Martina Navratilova's clothes the whole tournament, right?
Yes. This is a
day before the final, you get a deal.
Yep.
And you play the final in the new clothes. I can remember when Sloan won the U.S. Open 2017, I wore the same shirt. You know, you start winning and you don't know why you're winning. I mean, you know why you're winning, but you don't want to throw off anything. I wore the same shirt every time I went to a laundromat and washed that thing 3 or 4 times, you know, when it starts smelling. So, you know, most tennis players are very superstitious. Do you regret signing? Well, A, why do you think at that point in your career, I mean, you were on the map at that point.
I definitely think about it sometimes, because we are superstitious, and you know, I was superstitious, like, oh, you know, sure, we got to park the car right here and ask that person to move, you know, that kind of stuff. And but you know, I knew at heart, you know, and I would go back to the team, I knew at heart that, you know, my agents worked just to even get a deal. And I found out later, actually, I found out last year during the pandemic, my agent, Phil DiPicciana, he actually told me the story, and I never knew, like, it went down literally into me almost walking on the court, the deal, and making sure that it happened for me for multi-years and not just for the tournament, how they just wanted to give it for the tournament, and they worked it out. No, it's either about to be multi-years and whatever. So that was kind of a breakthrough at that time for a woman of color in my at my time getting that, so I couldn't kind of like pass it up. But I thought about it. Like, if I had to go back now, I probably was like, "Nah, I'm good. Let me just win the match." And then
the last question I'm gonna ask you is about a man named Willis Thomas. When I first started coaching Willis, you know, he started creeping around the corner. He's around, but you don't hear him. But you see him because you got this black dude with this pretty hair. I'm like, that dude got some pretty hair. So I remember Willis telling me, he was like, oh, Kamau, you ain't a real coach until you get fired a couple times. Zena hired and fired me about 4 times. What's the story behind that? And why would you hire and fire him?
Well, actually, I only had, I think, 4 or 5 coaches in my whole, you know, 15 years, which, you know, as we know, as tennis coaches come and go. So it wasn't that, you know, I actually kept coaches around more. Maybe I fired them and brought them back. But Willis Thomas was a big part of my career, because I grew up under John Wilkerson, who was extremely strict and, you know, just only believe you should eat and drink tennis, eat, sleep, and drink tennis, and that's it. And you shouldn't have any other part of the life. But Willis was the type of person that you should have a balanced life. And so I learned a lot about balance from Willis, and also about just growing up in life and also passing back, because passing on to others, because Willis was also one of those firm believer, you know, passing on knowledge to others as well. But one of the biggest things that I learned from Willis is probably learning to balance my life and enjoy it in the midst of everything as well.
So Why would you fire him?
I fired him because I'm a moody tennis player, like most moody tennis players. And, you know, you just sometimes think you need something different. But, you know, but I always brought him back. So as you know, from coaching, it's, you know, we can be moody in and out.
Oh, in and out. And it just, you just, sometimes you just need a break. You just need a break. Well, Zena, I appreciate you being so generous with your time. I appreciate you always being honest. I appreciate everything that you've given me over the years, your friendship, your mentorship, you showing me the ropes in the pro tennis and sort of, you know, how to do what's right. I think that a lot of times, especially in this sport, when your player is the boss, you sometimes are very hesitant to say and do what you know needs to be done, right? And, you know, you always, one of the biggest things you taught me was to just do your job. And your job is to help them win tennis matches, even if it hurts their feelings. You know what I mean? So I want to thank you for everything you, everything you've given to me. You know, I hope that, you know, tennis in general starts to appreciate your story and your role, not only, you know, for what you did back in the day, but what you still currently do and all the things that you do behind the scenes for a lot of players that are enjoying the, you know, the fruits of their labor right now. So I want to thank you. I want to give you your roses while you can still smell them. And I want to thank everybody for listening. This has been Tennis.com Podcast. I'm your host, Kamal Murray, and we were lucky enough to grab my friend and Olympic gold medalist during the Olympics, Zena Garrison. Zena, thank you so much.
Thank you. And good luck with your podcast.
Thank you, Zena.